view, largely the mother's. We have asked whether parents can be expected to have favourites, and in general, what is the best investment policy for a parent. But perhaps each child can influence how much his parents invest in him as against his brothers and sisters. Even if parents do not want to show favouritism among their children, could it be that children grab favoured treatment for themselves? Would it pay them to do so? More strictly, would genes for selfish grabbing among children become more numerous in the gene pool than rival genes for accepting no more than one's fair share? This matter has been brilliantly analysed by Trivers in a paper of 1974 called Parent-Offspring Conflict. A mother is equally related to all her children, born and to be born. On genetic grounds alone, she should have no favourites, as we have seen. If she does show favouritism, it should be based on differences in expectation of life, depending on age and other things. The mother, like any individual, is twice as closely related to herself as she is to any of her children. Other things being equal, this means that she should invest most of her resources selfishly in herself, but other things are not equal. She can do her genes more good by investing a fair proportion of her resources in her children. This is because these are younger and more helpless than she is, and they can therefore benefit more from each unit of investment than she can herself. Genes for investing in more helpless individuals in preference to oneself can prevail in the gene pool, even though the beneficiaries may share only a proportion of one's genes. This is why animals show parental altruism, and indeed why they show any kind of kin-selected altruism. Now look at it from the point of view of a particular child. He is just as closely related to each of his brothers and sisters as his mother is to them. The relatednesses are half in all cases. Therefore, he wants his mother to invest some of her resources in his brothers and sisters. Genetically speaking, he is just as altruistically disposed to them as his mother is. But again, he is twice as closely related to himself as he is to any brother or sister, and this will dispose him to want his mother to invest in him more than in any particular brother or sister, other things being equal. In this case, other things might indeed be equal. If you and your brother are the same age and both are in a position to benefit equally from a pint of mother's milk, you should try to grab more than your fair share, and he should try to grab more than his fair share. Have you ever heard a litter of piglets squealing to be first on the scene when the mother sow lies down to feed them? Or little boys fighting over the last slice of cake? Selfish greed seems to characterise much of child behaviour.
But there is more to it than this. If I am competing with my brother for a morsel of food, and if he is much younger than me so that he could benefit from the food more than I could, it might pay my genes to let him have it. An elder brother may have exactly the same grounds for altruism as a parent. In both cases, as we've seen, the relatedness is a half, and in both cases, the younger individual can make better use of the resource than the elder. If I possess a gene for giving up food, there's a 50% chance that my baby brother contains the same gene. Although the gene has double the chance of being in my own body, 100% it is in my body, my need of the food may be less than half as urgent. In general, a child should grab more than his share of parental investment, but only up to a point. Up to what point? Up to the point where the resulting net cost to his brothers and sisters, born and potentially to be born, is just double the benefit of the grabbing to himself. Consider the question of when weaning should take place. A mother wants to stop suckling her present child so that she can prepare for the next one. The present child, on the other hand, does not want to be weaned yet, because milk is a convenient, trouble-free source of food, and he does not want to have to go out and work for his living. To be more exact, he does want eventually to go out and work for his living, but only when he can do his genes more good by leaving his mother free to rear his little brothers and sisters than by staying behind himself. The older a child is, the less relative benefit does he derive from each pint of milk. This is because he is bigger and a pint of milk is therefore a smaller proportion of his requirement, and also he's becoming more capable of feeding for himself if he is forced to. Therefore, when an old child drinks a pint that could have been invested in a younger child, he is taking relatively more parental investment for himself than when a young child drinks a pint. As a child grows older, there will come a moment when it would pay his mother to stop feeding him and invest in a new child instead. Somewhat later, there will come a time when the old child, too, would benefit his genes most by weaning himself. This is the moment when a pint of milk can do more good to the copies of his genes that may be present in his brothers and sisters than it can to the genes that are present in himself. The disagreement between mother and child is not an absolute one, but a quantitative one. In this case, a disagreement over timing. The mother wants to go on suckling her present child up to the moment when investment in him reaches his fair share, taking into account his expectation of life and how much she has already invested in him. Up to this point, there is no disagreement. Similarly, both mother and child agree in not wanting him to go on sucking after the point when the cost to future children is more than double the benefit to him. But there is a disagreement between mother and child during the intermediate period, the period when the child is getting more than his share as the mother sees it, but when the cost to other children is still less than double the benefit to him.
Weaning time is just one example of a matter of dispute between mother and child. It could also be regarded as a dispute between one individual and all his future unborn brothers and sisters, with the mother taking the part of her future unborn children. More directly, there may be competition between contemporary rivals for her investment, between littermates or nestmates. Here, once again, the mother will normally be anxious to see fair play. Many baby birds are fed in the nest by their parents. They all gape and scream, and the parent drops a worm or other morsel in the open mouth of one of them. The loudness with which each baby screams is, ideally, proportional to how hungry he is. Therefore, if the parent always gives the food to the loudest screamer, they should all tend to get their fair share, since when one has had enough, he will not scream so loudly. At least that is what would happen in the best of all possible worlds if individuals did not cheat. But in the light of our selfish gene concept, we must expect that individuals will cheat, will tell lies about how hungry they are. This will escalate, apparently rather pointlessly, because it might seem that if they are all lying by screaming too loudly, this level of loudness will become the norm and will cease, in effect, to be a lie. However, it cannot de-escalate, because any individual who takes the first step in decreasing the loudness of his scream will be penalized by being fed less and is more likely to starve. Baby bird screams do not become infinitely loud because of other considerations. For example, loud screams tend to attract predators, and they use up energy. Sometimes, as we have seen, one member of a litter is a runt, much smaller than the rest. He is unable to fight for food as strongly as the rest, and runts often die. We have considered conditions under which it would actually pay a mother to let a runt die. We might suppose, intuitively, that the runt himself should go on struggling to the last, but the theory does not necessarily predict this. As soon as a runt becomes so small and weak that his expectation of life is reduced to the point where benefit to him, due to parental investment, is less than half the benefit that the same investment could potentially confer on the other babies, the runt should die gracefully and willingly. He can benefit his genes most by doing so. That is to say, a gene that gives the instruction, "Body, if you are very much smaller than your litter mates, give up the struggle and die," could be successful in the gene pool because it has a 50% chance of being in the body of each brother and sister saved, and its chances of surviving in the body of the runt are very small anyway. There should be a point of no return in the career of a runt. Before he reaches this point, he should go on struggling. As soon as he reaches it, he should give up and preferably let himself be eaten by his litter mates or his parents.
I did not mention it when we were discussing Lack's theory of clutch size, but the following is a reasonable strategy for a parent who is undecided as to what is her optimum clutch size for the current year. She might lay one more egg than she actually thinks is likely to be the true optimum. Then, if the year's food crop should turn out to be a better one than expected, she will rear the extra child. If not, she can cut her losses. By being careful always to feed the young in the same order, say in order of size, she sees to it that one, perhaps a runt, quickly dies, and not too much food is wasted on him beyond the initial investment of egg yolk or equivalent. From the mother's point of view, this may be the explanation of the runt phenomenon. He represents the hedging of the mother's bets. This has been observed in many birds. Using our metaphor of the individual animal as a survival machine, behaving as if it had the purpose of preserving its genes, we can talk about a conflict between parents and young, a battle of the generations. The battle is a subtle one, and no holds are barred on either side. A child will lose no opportunity of cheating. It will pretend to be hungrier than it is, perhaps younger than it is, more in danger than it really is. It is too small and weak to bully its parents physically, but it uses every psychological weapon at its disposal, lying, cheating, deceiving, exploiting, right up to the point where it starts to penalize its relatives more than its genetic relatedness to them should allow. Parents, on the other hand, must be alert to cheating and deceiving, and must try not to be fooled by it. This might seem an easy task. If the parent knows that its child is likely to lie about how hungry it is, it might employ the tactic of feeding it a fixed amount and no more, even though the child goes on screaming. One trouble with this is that the child may not have been lying, and if it dies as a result of not being fed, the parent would have lost some of its precious genes. Wild birds can die after being starved for only a few hours.
Asa Harvey has suggested a particularly diabolical form of child blackmail. The child screams in such a way as to attract predators deliberately to the nest. The child is saying, "Fox, fox, come and get me." The only way the parent can stop it screaming is to feed it. So the child gains more than its fair share of food, but at a cost of some risk to itself. The principle of this ruthless tactic is the same as that of the hijacker threatening to blow up an aeroplane with himself on board unless he is given a ransom. It seems unlikely that it could ever be favoured in evolution, not because it is too ruthless, but because it's doubtful that it could ever pay the blackmailing baby. He has too much to lose if a predator really came. This is clear for an only child, which is the case Sir Harvey himself considers. No matter how much his mother may already have invested in him, he should still value his own life more than his mother values it, since she has only half of his genes. Moreover, the tactic would not pay, even if the blackmailer was one of a clutch of vulnerable babies, all in the nest together, since the blackmailer has a 50% genetic stake in each of his endangered brothers and sisters, as well as a 100% stake in himself. The theory might conceivably work if the predominant predator had the habit of only taking the largest nestling from the nest. Then it might pay a smaller one to use the threat of summoning a predator, since it would not be greatly endangering itself. This is analogous to holding a pistol to your brother's head rather than threatening to blow yourself up.
More plausibly, the blackmail tactic might pay a baby cuckoo. As is well known, cuckoo females lay one egg in each of several foster nests, and then leave the unwitting foster parents of a quite different species to rear the cuckoo young. Therefore, a baby cuckoo has no genetic stake in his foster brothers and sisters. Some species of baby cuckoo will not have any foster brothers and sisters for a sinister reason which we shall come to. For the moment, I assume we are dealing with one of those species in which foster brothers and sisters coexist alongside the baby cuckoo. If a baby cuckoo screamed loudly enough to attract predators, it would have a lot to lose, its life, but the foster mother would have even more to lose, perhaps four of her young. It could therefore pay her to feed it more than its share, and the advantage of this to the cuckoo might outweigh the risk. This is one of those occasions when it would be wise to translate back into respectable gene language just to reassure ourselves that we have not become too carried away with subjective metaphors. What does it really mean to set up the hypothesis that baby cuckoos blackmail their foster parents by screaming, "Predator, predator, come and get me and all my little brothers and sisters"? In gene terms, it means the following. Cuckoo genes for screaming loudly became more numerous in the cuckoo gene pool because the loud screams increased the probability that the foster parents would feed the baby cuckoo. The reason the foster parents responded to the screams in this way was that genes for responding to the screams had spread through the gene pool of the foster species. The reason these genes spread was that individual foster parents who did not feed the cuckoos extra food reared fewer of their own children, fewer than rival parents who did feed their cuckoos extra. This was because predators were attracted to the nest by the cuckoo cries. Although cuckoo genes for not screaming were less likely to end up in the bellies of predators than screaming genes, the non-screaming cuckoos paid the greater penalty of not being fed extra rations. Therefore, the screaming genes spread through the cuckoo gene pool.
A similar chain of genetic reasoning, following the more subjective argument given above, would show that although such a blackmailing gene could conceivably spread through a cuckoo gene pool, it is unlikely to spread through the gene pool of an ordinary species, at least not for the specific reason that it attracted predators. Of course, in an ordinary species, there could be other reasons for screaming genes to spread, as we've already seen, and these would incidentally have the effect of occasionally attracting predators. But here, the selective influence of predation would be, if anything, in the direction of making the cries quieter. In the hypothetical case of the cuckoos, the net influence of predators, paradoxical as it sounds at first, could be to make the cries louder. There is no evidence one way or the other on whether cuckoos and other birds of similar brood parasitic habit actually employ the blackmail tactic, but they certainly do not lack ruthlessness. For instance, there are honey guides who, like cuckoos, lay their eggs in the nests of other species. The baby honey guide is equipped with a sharp, hooked beak. As soon as he hatches out, while he's still blind, naked, and otherwise helpless, he scythes and slashes his foster brothers and sisters to death. Dead brothers do not compete for food. The familiar British cuckoo achieves the same result in a slightly different way. It has a short incubation time, and so the baby cuckoo manages to hatch out before its foster brothers and sisters. As soon as it hatches, blindly and mechanically but with devastating effectiveness, it throws the other eggs out of the nest. It gets underneath an egg, fitting it into a hollow in its back. Then it slowly backs up the side of the nest, balancing the egg between its wing stubs, and topples the egg out onto the ground. It does the same with all the other eggs until it has the nest, and therefore the attention of its foster parents, entirely to itself.
One of the most remarkable facts I've learned in the past year while writing the book was reported from Spain by F. Alvarez, L. Arias-Terena, and H. Segura. They were investigating the ability of potential foster parents, potential victims of cuckoos, to detect intruders, cuckoo eggs or chicks. In the course of their experiments, they had occasion to introduce into magpie nests the eggs and chicks of cuckoos, and for comparison, eggs and chicks of other species such as swallows. On one occasion, they introduced a baby swallow into a magpie's nest. The next day, they noticed one of the magpie eggs lying on the ground under the nest. It had not broken, so they picked it up, replaced it, and watched. What they saw is utterly remarkable. The baby swallow, behaving exactly as if it was a baby cuckoo, threw the egg out. They replaced the egg again, and exactly the same thing happened. The baby swallow used the cuckoo method of balancing the egg on its back between its wing stubs and walking backwards up the side of the nest until the egg toppled out. Perhaps wisely, Alvarez and his colleagues made no attempt to explain their astonishing observation. How could such behaviour evolve in the swallow gene pool? It must correspond to something in the normal life of a swallow. Baby swallows are not accustomed to finding themselves in magpie nests. They are never normally found in any nest except their own. Could the behaviour represent an evolved anti-cuckoo adaptation? Has the natural selection been favouring a policy of counterattack in the swallow gene pool, genes for hitting the cuckoo with his own weapons? It seems to be a fact that swallows' nests are not normally parasitized by cuckoos. Perhaps this is why. According to this theory, the magpie eggs of the experiment would be incidentally getting the same treatment, perhaps because, like cuckoo eggs, they are bigger than swallow eggs. But if baby swallows can tell the difference between a large egg and a normal swallow egg, surely the mother should be able to as well. In this case, why is it not the mother who ejects the cuckoo egg, since it would be so much easier for her to do so than the baby? The same objection applies to the theory that the baby swallow's behaviour normally functions to remove adult eggs or other debris from the nest. Once again, this task could be, and is, performed better by the parent. The fact that the difficult and skilled egg rejection operation was seen to be performed by a weak and helpless baby swallow, whereas an adult swallow could surely do it much more easily, compels me to the conclusion that, from the parent's point of view, the baby is up to no good. It seems to me just conceivable that the true explanation has nothing to do with cuckoos at all. The blood may chill at the thought, but could this be what baby swallows do to each other? Since the firstborn is going to compete with his yet unhatched brothers and sisters for parental investment, it could be to his advantage to begin his life by throwing out one of the other eggs.
The lack theory of clutch size considered the optimum from the parent's point of view. If I am a mother swallow, the optimum clutch size from my point of view is, say, 5. But if I am a baby swallow, the optimum clutch size as I see it may well be a smaller number, provided I am one of them. The parent has a certain amount of parental investment which she wishes to distribute even-handedly among 5 young. But each baby wants more than his allotted 1/5 share. Unlike a cuckoo, he does not want all of it because he is related to the other babies. But he does want more than 1/5. He can acquire a quarter share simply by tipping out one egg, a 1/3 share by tipping out another. Translating into gene language, a gene for fratricide could conceivably spread through the gene pool because it has a 100% chance of being in the body of the fratricidal individual and only a 50% chance of being in the body of his victim. The chief objection to this theory is that it's very difficult to believe that nobody would have seen this diabolical behaviour if it really occurred. There is no convincing explanation for this. There are different races of swallow in different parts of the world. It's known that the Spanish race differs from, for example, the British one, in certain respects. The Spanish race has not been subjected to the same degree of intensive observation as the British one, and it is just conceivable that fratricide occurs but has been overlooked.
My reason for suggesting such an improbable idea as the fratricide hypothesis here is that I want to make a general point. This is that the ruthless behaviour of a baby cuckoo is only an extreme case of what must go on in any family. Full brothers are more closely related to each other than a baby cuckoo is to its foster brothers, but the difference is only a matter of degree. Even if we cannot believe that outright fratricide could evolve, there must be numerous lesser examples of selfishness where the cost to the child, in the form of losses to his brothers and sisters, is outweighed, more than 2-to-1, by the benefit to himself. In such cases, as in the example of weaning time, there is a real conflict of interest between parent and child. Who is most likely to win this battle of the generations? R.D. Alexander has written an interesting paper in which he suggests that there is a general answer to this question. According to him, the parent will always win. Now, if this is the case, you've been wasting your time reading this chapter. If Alexander is right, much that is of interest follows. For instance, altruistic behaviour could evolve not because of benefit to the genes of the individual himself, but solely because of benefit to his parents' genes. Parental manipulation, to use Alexander's term, becomes an alternative evolutionary cause of altruistic behaviour, independent of straightforward kin selection. It is therefore important that we examine Alexander's reasoning and convince ourselves that we understand why he is wrong. This should really be done mathematically, but we are avoiding explicit use of mathematics in this book, and it is possible to give an intuitive idea of what is wrong with Alexander's thesis. His fundamental genetic point is contained in the following abridged quotation.
Suppose that a juvenile causes an uneven distribution of parental benefits in its own favour, thereby reducing the mother's own overall reproduction. A gene which in this fashion improves an individual's fitness when it is a juvenile cannot fail to lower its fitness more when it is an adult, for such mutant genes will be present in an increased proportion of the mutant individual's offspring.
The fact that Alexander is considering a newly mutated gene is not fundamental to the argument. It is better to think of a rare gene inherited from one of the parents. Fitness has the special technical meaning of reproductive success. What Alexander is basically saying is this: a gene that made a child grab more than his fair share when he was a child, at the expense of his parents' total reproductive output, might indeed increase his chances of surviving. But he would pay the penalty when he came to be a parent himself, because his own children would tend to inherit the same selfish gene, and this would reduce his overall reproductive success. He would be hoist with his own petard. Therefore, the gene cannot succeed, and parents must always win the conflict. Our suspicions should be immediately aroused by this argument, because it rests on the assumption of a genetic asymmetry which is not really there. Alexander is using the words parent and offspring as though there was a fundamental genetic difference between them. As we have seen, although there are practical differences between parent and child, for instance, parents are older than children, and children come out of parents' bodies, there is really no fundamental genetic asymmetry. The relatedness is 50%, whichever way round you look at it. To illustrate what I mean, I'm going to repeat Alexander's words, but with parent, juvenile, and other appropriate words, reversed. Suppose that a parent has a gene that tends to cause an even distribution of parental benefits. A gene which in this fashion improves an individual's fitness when it is a parent could not fail to have lowered its fitness more when it was a juvenile. We therefore reach the opposite conclusion to Alexander, namely that in any parent-offspring conflict, the child must win. Obviously something is wrong here. Both arguments have been put too simply. The purpose of my reverse quotation is not to prove the opposite point to Alexander, but simply to show that you cannot argue in that kind of artificially asymmetrical way. Both Alexander's argument and my reversal of it erred through looking at things from the point of view of an individual, in Alexander's case the parent, in my case the child. I believe this kind of error is all too easy to make when we use the technical term fitness. This is why I have avoided using the word in this book. There is really only one entity whose point of view matters in evolution, and that entity is the selfish gene. Genes in juvenile bodies will be selected for their ability to outsmart parental bodies. Genes in parental bodies will be selected for their ability to outsmart the young. There is no paradox in the fact that the very same genes successively occupy a juvenile body and a parental body. Genes are selected for their ability to make the best of the levers of power at their disposal. They will exploit their practical opportunities. When a gene is sitting in a juvenile body, its practical opportunities will be different from when it is sitting in a parental body. Therefore, its optimum policy will be different in the two stages in its body's life history. There is no reason to suppose, as Alexander does, that the later optimum policy should necessarily overrule the earlier.
There is another way of putting the argument against Alexander. He is tacitly assuming a false asymmetry between the parent-child relationship on the one hand and the brother-sister relationship on the other. You will remember that according to Trivers, the cost to a selfish child of grabbing more than his share, the reason why he only grabs up to a point, is the danger of loss of his brothers and sisters, who each bear half his genes. But brothers and sisters are only a special case of relatives with a 50% relatedness. The selfish child's own future children are no more and no less valuable to him than his brothers and sisters. Therefore, the total net cost of grabbing more than your fair share of resources should really be measured not only in lost brothers and sisters, but also in lost future offspring due to their selfishness among themselves. Alexander's point about the disadvantage of juvenile selfishness spreading to your own children, thereby reducing your own long-term reproductive output, is well taken, but it simply means we must add this in to the cost side of the equation. An individual child will still do well to be selfish so long as the net benefit to him is at least half the net cost to close relatives. But close relatives should be read as including not just brothers and sisters, but future children of one's own as well. An individual should reckon his own welfare as twice as valuable as that of his brothers, which is the basic assumption Trivers makes. But he should also value himself twice as highly as one of his own future children. Alexander's conclusion that there is a built-in advantage on the parent's side in the conflict of interests is not correct. In addition to his fundamental genetic point, Alexander also has more practical arguments stemming from undeniable asymmetries in the parent-child relationship. The parent is the active partner, the one who actually does the work to get the food, etc., and is therefore in a position to call the tune. If the parent decides to withdraw its labour, there is not much that the child can do about it since it is smaller and cannot hit back. Therefore, the parent is in a position to impose its will regardless of what the child may want. This argument is not obviously wrong, since in this case the asymmetry that it postulates is a real one. Parents really are bigger, stronger, and more worldly wise than children. They seem to hold all the good cards. But the young have a few aces up their sleeves too. For example, it is important for a parent to know how hungry each of its children is, so that it can most efficiently dole out the food. It could, of course, ration the food exactly equally between them all, but in the best of all possible worlds, this would be less efficient than a system of giving a little bit more to those that could genuinely use it best. A system whereby each child told the parent how hungry he was would be ideal for the parent, and, as we have seen, such a system seems to have evolved. But the young are in a strong position to lie because they know exactly how hungry they are, while the parent can only guess whether they're telling the truth or not. It is almost impossible for a parent to detect a small lie, although it might see through a big one. Then again, it is of advantage to a parent to know when a baby is happy, and it's a good thing for a baby to be able to tell its parents when it is happy. Signals like purring and smiling may have been selected because they enable parents to learn which of their actions are most beneficial to their children. The sight of her child smiling or the sound of her kitten purring is rewarding to a mother in the same sense as food in the stomach is rewarding to a rat in a maze. But once it becomes true that a sweet smile or a loud purr are rewarding, the child is in a position to use the smile or the purr in order to manipulate the parent and gain more than its fair share of parental investment.
End note. Alexander has generously conceded in his 1980 book, Darwinism and Human Affairs, that he was wrong to argue that parental victory in parent-offspring conflict follows inevitably from fundamental Darwinian assumptions. It now seems to me that his thesis that parents enjoy an asymmetrical advantage over their offspring in the battle of the generations could be bolstered by a different kind of argument, which I learnt from Eric Charnoff. Charnoff was writing about social insects and the origins of sterile castes, but his argument applies more generally, and I shall put it in general terms. Consider a young female of a monogamous species, not necessarily an insect, on the threshold of adult life. Her dilemma is whether to leave and try to reproduce on her own or stay in the parental nest and help rear her younger brothers and sisters. Because of the breeding habits of her species, she can be confident that her mother will go on giving her full brothers and sisters for a long time to come. By Hamilton's logic, these sibs are just as genetically valuable to her as her own offspring would be. As far as genetic relatedness is concerned, the young female will be indifferent between the two courses of action. She doesn't care whether she goes or stays, but her parents will be far from indifferent to which she does. Looked at from the point of view of her old mother, the choice is between grandchildren or children. New children are twice as valuable, genetically speaking, as new grandchildren. If we speak of conflict between parents and offspring over whether the offspring leaves or stays and helps at the nest, Charnoff's point is that the conflict is a walkover for the parents for the very good reason that only the parents see it as a conflict at all. It is a bit like a race between two athletes, where one has been offered £1,000 only if he wins, while his opponent has been promised £1,000 whether he wins or loses. We should expect that the first runner will try harder, and that, if the two are otherwise evenly matched, he will probably win. Actually, Charnoff's point is stronger than this analogy suggests, because the costs of running flat out are not so great as to deter many people, whether they are financially rewarded or not. Such Olympic ideals are too much of a luxury for the Darwinian games. Effort in one direction is always paid for as lost effort in another direction. It is as if the more effort you put into any one race, the less likely you are to win future races because of exhaustion. Conditions will vary from species to species, so we can't always forecast the results of Darwinian games. Nevertheless, if we consider only closeness of genetic relatedness and assume a monogamous mating system so that the daughter can be sure that her sibs are full sibs, we can expect an old mother to succeed in manipulating her young adult daughter into staying and helping. The mother has everything to gain, while the daughter herself will have no inducement to resist her mother's manipulation, because she is genetically indifferent between the available choices. Once again, it is important to stress that this has been an other things being equal kind of argument. Even though other things will usually not be equal, Charnoff's reasoning could still be useful to Alexander or anyone else advocating a parental manipulation theory. In any case, Alexander's practical arguments for expecting parental victory, parents being bigger, stronger, and so on, are well taken.
There is, then, no general answer to the question of who is more likely to win the battle of the generations. What will finally emerge is a compromise between the ideal situation desired by the child and that desired by the parent. It is a battle comparable to that between cuckoo and foster parent, not such a fierce battle, to be sure, for the enemies do have some genetic interests in common. They are only enemies up to a point or during certain sensitive times. However, many of the tactics used by cuckoos, tactics of deception and exploitation, may be employed by a parent's own young, although the parent's own young will stop short of the total selfishness that is to be expected of a cuckoo.
This chapter, and the next in which we discuss conflict between mates, could seem horribly cynical and might even be distressing to human parents, devoted as they are to their children and to each other. Once again, I must emphasize that I am not talking about conscious motives. Nobody is suggesting that children deliberately and consciously deceive their parents because of the selfish genes within them. And I must repeat that when I say something like, a child should lose no opportunity of cheating, lying, deceiving, exploiting, I'm using the word should in a special way. I'm not advocating this kind of behavior as moral or desirable. I'm simply saying that natural selection will tend to favor children who do act in this way, and that therefore, when we look at wild populations, we may expect to see cheating and selfishness within families. The phrase, the child should cheat, means that genes that tend to make children cheat have an advantage in the gene pool. If there is a human moral to be drawn, it is that we must teach our children altruism, for we cannot expect it to be part of their biological nature.
Chapter 9. Battle of the Sexes. If there is conflict of interest between parents and children, who share 50% of each other's genes, how much more severe must be the conflict between mates, who are not related to each other.
End note. As so often, this opening sentence hides an implicit other things being equal. Obviously, mates are likely to have a great deal to gain from cooperation. This emerges again and again throughout the chapter. After all, mates are likely to be engaged in a non-zero-sum game, a game in which both can increase their winnings by cooperating, rather than one's gain necessarily being the other's loss. I explain this idea in Chapter 12. This is one of the places in the book where my tone swung too far towards the cynical, selfish view of life. At the time it seemed necessary, since the dominant view of animal courtship had swung far in the other direction. Nearly universally, people had uncritically assumed that mates would cooperate unstintingly with each other. The possibility of exploitation wasn't even considered. In this historical context, the apparent cynicism of my opening sentence is understandable, but today I would adopt a softer tone. Similarly, at the end of this chapter, my remarks about human sexual roles now seem to me naively worded. Two books that go more thoroughly into the evolution of human sex differences are Martin Daly and Margot Wilson's Sex, Evolution and Behaviour, and Donald Simons's The Evolution of Human Sexuality.
All that mates have in common is a 50% genetic shareholding in the same children. Since father and mother are both interested in the welfare of different halves of the same children, there may be some advantage for both of them in cooperating with each other in rearing those children. If one parent can get away with investing less than his or her fair share of costly resources in each child, however, he will be better off, since he will have more to spend on other children by other sexual partners, and so propagate more of his genes. Each partner can therefore be thought of as trying to exploit the other, trying to force the other one to invest more. Ideally, what an individual would like, that doesn't mean physically enjoy, although he or she might, would be to copulate with as many members of the opposite sex as possible, leaving the partner in each case to bring up the children. As we shall see, this state of affairs is achieved by the males of a number of species, but in other species the males are obliged to share an equal part of the burden of bringing up children. This view of sexual partnership as a relationship of mutual mistrust and mutual exploitation has been stressed especially by Trivers. It is a comparatively new one to ethologists. We'd usually thought of sexual behaviour, copulation, and the courtship that precedes it as essentially a cooperative venture undertaken for mutual benefit, or even for the good of the species.
Let us go right back to first principles and inquire into the fundamental nature of maleness and femaleness. In Chapter 3 we discuss sexuality without stressing its basic asymmetry. We simply accepted that some animals are called male and others female without asking what these words really meant. But what is the essence of maleness? What at bottom defines a female? We as mammals see the sexes defined by whole syndromes of characteristics: possession of a penis, bearing of the young, suckling by means of special milk glands, certain chromosomal features, and so on. These criteria for judging the sex of an individual are all very well for mammals, but for animals and plants generally, they are no more reliable than is the tendency to wear trousers as a criterion for judging human sex. In frogs, for instance, neither sex has a penis. Perhaps then, the words male and female have no general meaning. They are, after all, only words, and if we do not find them helpful for describing frogs, we are quite at liberty to abandon them. We could arbitrarily define frogs into sex 1 and sex 2 if we wished. However, there is one fundamental feature of the sexes which can be used to label males as males and females as females throughout animals and plants. This is that the sex cells, or gametes, of males are much smaller and more numerous than the gametes of females. This is true whether we are dealing with animals or plants. One group of individuals has large sex cells, and it is convenient to use the word female for them. The other group, which it is convenient to call male, has small sex cells. The difference is especially pronounced in reptiles and in birds, where a single egg cell is big enough and nutritious enough to feed a developing baby for several weeks. Even in humans, where the egg is microscopic, it is still many times larger than the sperm. As we shall see, it is possible to interpret all the other differences between the sexes as stemming from this one basic difference.
In certain primitive organisms, for instance some fungi, maleness and femaleness do not occur, although sexual reproduction of a kind does. In the system known as isogamy, the individuals are not distinguishable into two sexes. Anybody can mate with anybody else. There are not two different sorts of gametes, sperms and eggs, but all sex cells are the same, called isogametes. New individuals are formed by the fusion of two isogametes, each produced by meiotic division. If we have three isogametes, A, B and C, A could fuse with B or C, B could fuse with A or C. The same is never true of normal sexual systems. If A is a sperm and it can fuse with B or C, then B and C must be eggs and B cannot fuse with C. When two isogametes fuse, both contribute equal numbers of genes to the new individual and they also contribute equal amounts of food reserves. Sperms and eggs, too, contribute equal numbers of genes, but eggs contribute far more in the way of food reserves. Indeed, sperms make no contribution at all and are simply concerned with transporting their genes as fast as possible to an egg. At the moment of conception, therefore, the father has invested less than his fair share, 50%, of resources in the offspring. Since each sperm is so tiny, a male can afford to make many millions of them every day. This means he's potentially able to beget a very large number of children in a very short period of time using different females. This is only possible because each new embryo is endowed with adequate food by the mother in each case. This therefore places a limit on the number of children a female can have, but the number of children a male can have is virtually unlimited. Female exploitation begins here.
End note. It now seems misleading to emphasize the disparity between sperm and egg size as the basis of sex roles. Even if one sperm is small and cheap, it is far from cheap to make millions of sperms and successfully inject them into a female against all the competition. I now prefer the following approach to explaining the fundamental asymmetry between males and females. Suppose we start with two sexes that have none of the particular attributes of males and females. Call them by the neutral names A and B. All we need specify is that every mating has to be between an A and a B. Now, any animal, whether an A or a B, faces a trade-off. Time and effort devoted to fighting with rivals cannot be spent on rearing existing offspring, and vice versa. Any animal can be expected to balance its effort between these rival claims. The point I'm about to come to is that the A's may settle at a different balance from the B's, and that, once they do, there is likely to be an escalating disparity between them. To see this, suppose that the two sexes, the A's and the B's, differ from one another right from the start in whether they can most influence their success by investing in children or by investing in fighting. I'll use fighting to stand for all kinds of direct competition within one sex. Initially, the difference between the sexes can be very slight, since my point will be that there is an inherent tendency for it to grow. Say the A's start out with fighting making a greater contribution to their reproductive success than parental behaviour does. The B's, on the other hand, start out with parental behaviour contributing slightly more than fighting to variation in their reproductive success. This means, for example, that although an A of course benefits from parental care, the difference between a successful carer and an unsuccessful carer among the A's is smaller than the difference between a successful fighter and an unsuccessful fighter among the A's. Among the B's, just the reverse is true. So for a given amount of effort, an A can do itself good by fighting, whereas a B is more likely to do itself good by shifting its effort away from fighting and towards parental care. In subsequent generations, therefore, the A's will fight a bit more than their parents, the bees will fight a bit less and care a bit more than their parents. Now, the difference between the best day and the worst day with respect to fighting will be even greater. The difference between the best day and the worst day with respect to caring will be even less. Therefore, an A has even more to gain by putting its effort into fighting, even less to gain by putting its effort into caring. Exactly the opposite will be true of the bees as the generations go by. The key idea here is that a small initial difference between the sexes can be self-enhancing. Selection can start with an initial slight difference and make it grow larger and larger, until the A's become what we now call males, the B's what we now call females. The initial difference can be small enough to arise at random. After all, the starting conditions of the two sexes are unlikely to be exactly identical. As you will notice, this is rather like the theory, originating with Parker, Baker and Smith, of the early separation of primitive gametes into sperms and eggs. The argument just given is more general. The separation into sperms and eggs is only one aspect of a more basic separation of sexual roles. Instead of treating the sperm-egg separation as primary and tracing all the characteristic attributes of males and females back to it, we now have an argument that explains the sperm-egg separation and other aspects all in the same way. We have to assume only that there are two sexes who have to mate with each other. We need know nothing more about those sexes. Starting from this minimal assumption, we positively expect that, however equal the two sexes may be at the start, they will diverge into two sexes specializing in opposite and complementary reproductive techniques. The separation between sperms and eggs is a symptom of this more general separation, not the cause of it.
G. A. Parker, R. R. Baker, and V. G. F. Smith showed how this asymmetry might have evolved from an originally isogamous state of affairs. In the days when all sex cells were interchangeable and of roughly the same size, there would have been some that just happened to be slightly bigger than others. In some respects, a big isogamete would have an advantage over an average-sized one because it would get its embryo off to a good start by giving it a large initial food supply. There might therefore have been an evolutionary trend towards larger gametes. But there was a catch. The evolution of isogametes that were larger than was strictly necessary would have opened the door to selfish exploitation. Individuals who produced smaller than average gametes could cash in, provided they could ensure that their small gametes fused with extra big ones. This could be achieved by making the small ones more mobile and able to seek out large ones actively. The advantage to an individual of producing small, rapidly moving gametes would be that he could afford to make a larger number of gametes, and therefore could potentially have more children. Natural selection favoured the production of sex cells that were small and that actively sought out big ones to fuse with. So we can think of two divergent sexual strategies evolving. There was the large investment, or honest strategy. This automatically opened the way for a small investment, exploitative strategy. Once the divergence between the two strategies had started, it would have continued in runaway fashion. Medium-sized intermediates would have been penalized because they did not enjoy the advantages of either of the two more extreme strategies. The exploiters would have evolved smaller and smaller size and faster mobility. The honest ones would have evolved larger and larger size to compensate for the ever smaller investment contributed by the exploiters, and they became immobile because they would always be actively chased by the exploiters anyway. Each honest one would prefer to fuse with another honest one, but the selection pressure to lock out exploiters would have been weaker than the pressure on exploiters to duck under the barrier. The exploiters had more to lose, and they therefore won the evolutionary battle. The honest ones became eggs, and the exploiters became sperms. Males, then, seem to be pretty worthless fellows, and on simple good-of-the-species grounds, we might expect that males would become less numerous than females. Since one male can theoretically produce enough sperms to service a harem of 100 females, we might suppose that females should outnumber males in animal populations by 100 to 1. Other ways of putting this are that the male is more expendable and the female more valuable to the species. Of course, looked at from the point of view of the species as a whole, this is perfectly true. To take an extreme example, in one study of elephant seals, 4% of the males accounted for 88% of all the copulations observed. In this case, and in many others, there is a large surplus of bachelor males who probably never get a chance to copulate in their whole lives. But these extra males live otherwise normal lives, and they eat up the population's food resources no less hungrily than other adults. From a good of the species point of view, this is horribly wasteful. The extra males might be regarded as social parasites. This is just one more example of the difficulties that the group selection theory gets into. The selfish gene theory, on the other hand, has no trouble in explaining the fact that the numbers of males and females tend to be equal, even when the males who actually reproduce may be a small fraction of the total number. The explanation was first offered by R.A. Fisher.
The problem of how many males and how many females are born is a special case of a problem in parental strategy. Just as we discussed the optimal family size for an individual parent trying to maximize her gene survival, we can also discuss the optimal sex ratio. Is it better to entrust your precious genes to sons or to daughters? Suppose a mother invested all her resources in sons and therefore had none left to invest in daughters. Would she, on average, contribute more to the gene pool of the future than a rival mother who invested in daughters? Do genes for preferring sons become more or less numerous than genes for preferring daughters? What Fisher showed is that under normal circumstances, the stable sex ratio is 50-50. In order to see why, we must first know a little bit about the mechanics of sex determination. In mammals, sex is determined genetically as follows. All eggs are capable of developing into either a male or a female. It is the sperms that carry the sex-determining chromosomes. Half the sperms produced by a man are female-producing or X sperms, and half are male-producing or Y sperms. The two sorts of sperms look alike. They differ with respect to one chromosome only. A gene for making a father have nothing but daughters could achieve its object by making him manufacture nothing but X sperms. A gene for making a mother have nothing but daughters could work by making her secrete a selective spermicide or by making her abort male embryos. What we seek is something equivalent to an evolutionarily stable strategy, ESS, although here, even more than in the chapter on aggression, strategy is just a figure of speech. An individual cannot literally choose the sex of his children, but genes for tending to have children of one sex or the other are possible. If we suppose that such genes favoring unequal sex ratios exist, are any of them likely to become more numerous in the gene pool than their rival alleles, which favor an equal sex ratio?
Suppose that, in the elephant seals mentioned above, a mutant gene arose that tended to make parents have mostly daughters. Since there is no shortage of males in the population, the daughters would have no trouble finding mates, and the gene for manufacturing daughters could spread. The sex ratio in the population might then start to shift towards a surplus of females. From the point of view of the good of the species, this will be all right because just a few males are quite capable of providing all the sperms needed for even a huge surplus of females, as we have seen. Superficially, therefore, we might expect the daughter-producing gene to go on spreading until the sex ratio was so unbalanced that the few remaining males, working flat out, could just manage. But now, think what an enormous genetic advantage is enjoyed by those few parents who have sons. Anyone who invests in a son has a very good chance of being the grandparent of hundreds of seals. Those who are producing nothing but daughters are assured of a safe few grandchildren, but this is nothing compared to the glorious genetic possibilities that open up before anyone specializing in sons. Therefore, genes for producing sons will tend to become more numerous, and the pendulum will swing back.
For simplicity, I've talked in terms of a pendulum swing. In practice, the pendulum would never have been allowed to swing that far in the direction of female domination, because the pressure to have sons would have started to push it back as soon as the sex ratio became unequal.